This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. It's my pleasure to welcome Susan Lassiter-Lyons to the show. She is the founder of Investor Insights, twice voted the number one real estate investing blog, and author of Getting the Money, The Simple Secret for Getting Private Money for Your Real Estate Deals. Susan, welcome. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm very well, thanks.
It's good to have you, and you're coming to us from Denver, Colorado today, right?
Yes, sunny and warm today, Denver, Colorado.
Fantastic. Well, you know, it's kind of a contrary to popular belief, maybe popular belief, I don't know. We used to do quite a bit of business in Denver years ago, and Denver has a lot of sunshine, even though it can be chilly. It's a sunny place.
It is, yeah, but don't tell anyone because we like to keep that a secret.
Good, yeah, otherwise they'll all come there, right? Yeah,
right.
Absolutely, good. You're into various areas of real estate investing as you teach people how to invest. And mm-hmm. I want to ask you maybe first, let's just start off and we'll cover some other areas too, but bulk REO purchases, as we were going through and in the years immediately following, and even now still to a lesser extent, the Great Recession, as it's called, everybody's talked about buying tapes or buying pools of REOs and maybe getting these incredible deals on bulk REO purchases. First of all, is that true? Are those deals really even that good? I've noticed that a lot of them are filled up with some good properties and some real junky ones at the same time. And, you know, they want you to buy the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle. And then also whether or not it is true. And, you know, are those opportunities still around or have they all been gobbled up by now?
Yeah, you know, the bulk REO strategy, which really is just a lead generation strategy, it's a way to get access to a lot of potential deals all at once. And, you know, certainly great for people who want purchase properties at discounts and also people that are doing higher volumes. It works out really well. I tell you, back in the day, you know, just after 2008, I guess, banks started taking back properties left and right, right? So had a ton of foreclosures, and REO just is an acronym for real estate owned. And it just means that in terms of the bank's balance sheet, it's moved from the performing side of the sheet to the non-performing side of the sheet. And so they foreclosed on these properties, and now they're holding these properties in their portfolio, and they're looking for a way to unload them. Now, the interesting thing about the way it works with holding REO on your books as a bank is that, you know, if you have FDIC insurance, which let's hope that all the banks have, right, that we're trusting with our money.
Well, actually, I'll take it a step further than that, Susan. Let's hope that they don't need it, number one. But number two, if they do, that there's actually enough money to pay the claims.
Right, absolutely.
But that's another rabbit hole, but yeah.
Yeah, well, the FDIC basically has a requirement that, you know, for every non-performing asset that you're holding on your books, and certainly a foreclosed property that's not generating any income would qualify as that, you have to offset that burden by having a certain amount of cash set aside in cash reserves. So in just, you know, the most simplest terms, what it means is if a bank has a lot of non-performing assets or foreclosures, they have to have a lot of cash reserved. And that means that that cash that they're reserving isn't earning any money. And that's how banks make their money. So it's definitely in the best interest of the bank to be able to move these non-performing assets off of their books as quickly as possible. And so, you know, when they were taking back tons tons and tons of properties, you know, when the foreclosure crisis was at its height, you know, they were looking for ways to move these things very quickly. And so we started just referring to it as bulk REO purchases, where a real estate investor or a company could get in touch with a bank and we could get a look at their tape, as you call it. And it's just a tape is just a fancy way of just referring to an Excel spreadsheet most of the time, or a PDF that these banks will send you, which is just a list of the foreclosed properties that they have on their books. And then you could make an offer either on like a onesie, twosie basis for whatever they're carrying on the books, or preferably, like you mentioned, the banks would want you to just buy the whole tape so that they could offload all of those properties.
We've looked at a lot of those and it seems so attractive. I mean, I remember back in 2007, 2008, 2009, and of course after that, we looked at a bunch of different tapes and it just seemed like it was hairy. I'll put it that way. That might be the right word for it. You know, was never really what you wanted. But I don't know. You know, obviously lots of people purchase tapes, or really institutions did mostly. Go ahead with what you're saying, but also make sure we address what sizes did these come in? I mean, could you buy, what was the smallest? And then, of course, there are some huge tapes that were sold out there.
Right. So if you look at some of the larger institutions like, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, those types of things, and even the larger banks like Bank of America, Chase, and so forth, they'll let you get a look at their tapes, but there's a price attached, right? So they've got millions and millions of dollars worth of properties on these spreadsheets that they're looking to offload to usually institutions. You know, hedge funds were formed a few years ago when Warren Buffett made the comment that, you know, if he could figure out a way to do it elegantly, he would buy up every foreclosed single family property in the United States and turn it into a rental. And so, you know, there were some hedge funds listening and they did just that. And some of the bigger ones came in and bought some of these larger tapes, where it's fine for the institutional investor, or the hedge fund investor, to compete at that level when like a Bank of America is charging you a $100,000 fee just to register as someone that they would make that tape available to. That's not even the right to bid or anything. It's just to be able to look at the assets.
Right.
So, you know,
so that'll keep the dreamers out.
Yeah. The tire kickers, as we say.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's, I work with the smaller real estate investor and I don't work with many institutions unless I'm doing fund advising. But when we were looking at cracking this bulk REO nut for the smaller investor, instead of going to the larger, like national, multinational banks and, you know, institutions like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, who have just thousands and thousands of these properties. And, you know, people are playing at the level of, hey, they're going to put together like a $100 million or $200 million fund in order to acquire this tape of properties at those institutions. We focused more on what I refer to as portfolio lenders. And portfolio lenders are just those smaller local or maybe regional banks, right? You see them all the time. You'll drive down the street and you'll see something that just looks random, like, you know, Soleil Bank. You're like, Soleil, what the heck is that, right? There's just one Soleil Bank in the state. It's not like it's part of a chain and you're not going to find it in the grocery store or in a strip mall or anything like that. So I started approaching the local portfolio lenders when I had my mortgage company, because I had to get my real estate investors refinanced out of some hard money loans that my fund had made. And so through doing that, these lenders who were taking back a whole bunch of non-performing properties and foreclosure properties just happened to mention, hey, you know, would you like to take a look at the inventory that we have available? We know that you're an investor yourself, and we know that you work and represent a lot of other investors, and maybe you guys would like to help us offload these. So we started getting tapes in that way. And honestly, back then, I didn't even really know what it was as a concept or a strategy, you know, for bulk REO investing. I just knew that it was an opportunity to get access to a whole bunch of properties at once for a pretty steep discount. And so what we found was, you know, at that time, depending on the location, depending on, you know, the type of property that it was, and, you know, certainly depending on if they've done any kind of broker price opinion or anybody's taken a look at the properties and was able to categorize them by the repairs that they needed, we could take a look at a tape and get discounts anywhere, you know, from like an 80-cent discount on the dollar up to, you know, like maybe a 40 or 50% discount on the dollar. So it's pretty cool when you look at a tape and just depending on what your strategy is and depending on where you're investing, to be able to pay like, you know, 20 to 60 cents on the dollar for a bulk package of properties.
Oh, yeah. Everybody listening, their mouth is watering, I'm sure. But With those small portfolio, local community bank type lenders, those are probably all in the same, certainly city or region of cities. I mean, we've worked with a lot of those and they'll be, you know, they'll be in a fairly condensed area, which is nice for the small investor, right? But the properties will be all over the spectrum in terms of price and quality and neighborhoods and so forth. And and then the various states of disrepair. I mean, of course, some people just, they would break through the walls and steal the copper pipes. And it's mind-boggling. Some of these properties I've looked at over the years, you know, I'm sure you've seen them too. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, it just really depends. You know, I mean, I can look at a tape and think, wow, you know, out of like maybe 10 or 15 properties on this tape from a local lender, maybe there are only five that I would have any interest at all in either, you know, bringing into my business on the rehabbing side or the landlord side, the buy and hold side. But, you know, there's opportunity in the properties. If the bank will let you cherry pick, right, make offers on the individual properties from that tape that you would want to have and not have to bid on the ones that you don't want to have, that's obviously ideal. But if you have to take the ones that are probably don't totally meet your ideal investment criteria on the front end, you get them, you know, typically for such a deep discount that I don't really see that it's much of a problem. There's always ways to monetize either your overflow leads or your overflow deals. And, you know, if you have an active buyers list in that certain area that you're working in, you can put it through your wholesaling division. I worked with a guy, his name is Tom Cook, and he's based in California. And he and his wife came to me several years ago and said, look, you know, we want to start a rehabbing business and we also want to start a buy and hold business, single family homes. We need a big bang for our buck. It's not feasible for us to do it in California because the home prices are so high. So they started looking at St. Louis. And so we hooked him up with a local portfolio lender, had a package of 10 properties. He and his wife closed on, they bought the whole package. They got all 10 properties. Out of those 10, they rehabbed five of them. So they chose five of the 10 properties. They rehabbed them, got them Section 8 qualified, and put a tenant in place and kept those properties in their portfolio, the local St. Louis portfolio. The other five, they're like, no way. We don't have any interest in doing that. So what they did was they just flipped those deals on a wholesale basis, like a fire sale, to some other cash buyer investors that happened to be working in the area. And so the proceeds that they were able to get from wholesaling those five properties wasn't totally enough to cover the rehab and the costs for the properties that they were positioning for, you know, their buy and hold business, but it certainly was pretty close. So it kind of became like this self-funding proposition. And, you know, they still have those properties and they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So those are the kind of stories, you know, and kind of what we're talking about in the niche of bulk REO. I'm not saying like, you know, buy 100 properties and out of those 100 properties, you know, you're lucky if you're going to, you know, have two that are good and you're going to get stuck with 98 and you're going to go bankrupt. That's not the conversation. The conversation is if you're looking to acquire properties in bulk rapidly in a specific area, then this should be something that you could look at because you can get a discount and can usually move them pretty quickly. These are off-market listings, right? So everybody else is competing on the MLS. If you're going direct to the bank, then you have something that other cash buyers and other investors in that area don't have access to.
So Susan, let's talk a little bit about financing. This is the thing that is probably the biggest challenge in the real estate investing world. Once you learn how to do it, everybody can learn how to find deals. Sometimes it takes more time than others to find those deals, but it can be done. But especially for beginning investors, financing is always an issue on the buy and hold side of the real estate investing spectrum. Long-term financing, more than 10 loans. We've got Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac restrictions now on those agency loans, obviously. So if you want to speak to that, any on the longer-term side of financing, that'd be great too. Certainly hard money options out there. And we can talk about it from the side of the borrower and the investor or lender as well. I'll take it wherever you like.
So yeah, you know, I started investing in real estate back in 1994. And the biggest constraint for me was always the funding side of things. It's, we have two jobs as real estate investors. We have to find deals and then we have to find capital in order to fund those deals. And I had no problem at all finding deals, right? That definitely wasn't the problem. The problem for me was the funding side. And, you know, for years, I always heard from the quote, you know, making like air quotes now in the air with my fingers, the gurus, they'd always say, you know, if the deal is good enough, then the funding will just appear. And that never has been my experience.
Somehow that doesn't really happen that way in real life, but yeah. It sounds spoiler good when they're alert, trying to sell you their info happens. Product. Yeah. Right.
So I was like, all right, so that's a big lie. Now I'm going to have to really figure this thing out for myself.
Right.
You know, back in 2006, 2007, the conventional loans were just crazy. We called them pulse loans. Investors could get 100% like no doc loans in order to fund their real estate investing purchases. And we called it a pulse loan because they didn't take anything at all about the borrower. It was like, hey, if you have a pulse, congratulations, you're approved. Obviously, with the big mortgage meltdown that happened, we don't have those loans anymore. And I'm glad we don't have those loans anymore, but obviously it put up an additional constraint for borrowers, investor borrowers specifically. You know, a lot of full-time investors certainly weren't paying themselves a salary, so they didn't have W-2s or tax documentation in order to prove their income to be able to qualify for, you know, residential loans from conventional lenders. And so kind of the two-pronged system that I personally discovered and that I used and that I teach and that my students have success with now and still to this day is a combination of private money and portfolio lenders, right? Those same exact portfolio lenders that we were just chatting about in the bulk REO portion of this discussion. It was, you know, I've worked with portfolio lenders and local lenders for many, many years and developed great relationships with them. And the cool thing about portfolio lenders is that because they don't securitize and sell off their loans into the secondary markets, they don't have to follow the rules of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of those, you know, things that you talked about earlier when you were talking about Freddie and Fannie and the maximum 10 property rule and there's seasoning rules and there's a maximum on the amount of cash out you can get on your own deals. And I mean, all sorts of crazy rules. Well, those rules are in place because the Wall Street buyers want to buy a uniform security. Right. So if you're putting something into a tranche or a pool with other loans, they want the characteristics of the loan to be very similar. With portfolio lenders, they're like, look, we're not selling anything off into the secondary markets. And so we have an in-house credit committee that's made up of people that work here at the bank or people that are on the board of the bank. And we look at each loan individually and evaluate it on the merits. And the cool thing about working with portfolio lenders as a real estate investor is that even on residential properties, right, the single family homes up to 4 units, they underwrite them just like they do commercial loans, which means that they look to the cash flow that that property produces, as opposed to just like the debt to income ratio and the credit score of the borrower. So I think that it's more of a common sense approach. And so we're able to do some pretty creative loans still with portfolio lenders, like, you know, blanket loans and unseasoned cash out refinances and an unlimited number of loans in the name of your entity that don't get reported to your personal credit report. And as long as everything is, you know, across the portfolio is still cash flowing and can meet their minimum debt service coverage ratio, then they're cool with it. As far as like private money is concerned.
Well, let me just stop you there for a moment.
Yeah.
That all sounds wonderful, but I just want the listeners to know that, of course, one of the reasons that real estate financing and real estate in general in the U.S. is so attractive is that ever since the Great Depression, it's been subsidized by the government through these pseudo-governmental entities, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, right? And so the rates that you're going to see on those loans are not as attractive as what you'll see on Fannie Freddie, but they're pretty good. You know, they're not that bad either. But the thing that's so tough, Susan, you know, I'd love to have you speak to this with investors and just traditional home buyers back when I owned a traditional real estate company also, is that we're all so spoiled here. We have such attractive mortgages. They're so cheap. The private market has probably now more than ever in my career is starting to really close that gap. I mean, even the alternative financing sources like B2R and First Key and so forth and some others out there, it's not that different than the Fannie Freddie loans, but it's still far more attractive to get those typical agency loans because, again, you have that government backing or that implicit guarantee, as we heard so much during the Great Recession and as the mortgage meltdown was occurring. You know, I think investors just have to adjust their expectations. You know, we have artificially good mortgage deals, terms and rates in the U.S., 30-year fixed at incredibly low rates that arguably it's free money. When you look at real inflation versus those typical agency rates, you're probably borrowing for free or close to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And, you know, which is why I kind of take exception to the comment that you just made about, you know, there being like a big disparity between the rates that you'll find from an agency loan versus a portfolio lender, especially
not a big
on an
one.
Investor
I,
loan.
I said they're closing the gap, but
yeah,
it's still higher.
Right, so, yeah. For example, I have a student, he just refinanced, did an unseasoned cash out refinance on 5 single family homes in Indianapolis. And he had a conventional loan on those properties that was about 7.25%. He was able to get a portfolio lender to put a blanket loan, blanket cash out refinance on all those properties. He got about $400,000 cash out and the interest rate was 5.25%.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty darn good rate.
That is a darn good rate, but yeah, his 7.5 rate was a rate he got quite a while ago, probably, because
yeah,
he could do much better than that on an agency loan today. But yeah,
can't
that's a great deal.
Qualify for an agency loan
yeah, right.
today.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Don't you wish you could?
Yeah.
You know, in the old days, you could get hundreds of those loans. Now you can only have
But you
10,
can't today, which
10,
is why, you know, the two-pronged strategy that I teach with portfolio loans and private money.
Yeah.
Because
yes,
the majority of my students, you know, we're dealing with portfolio lenders because there are rules that we need to break. Either they're a self-employed investor and they don't have W-2s that could substantiate, you know, through a debt-to-income ratio, the underwriting process on an agency loan, or, you know, they don't have enough cash reserves or they've got more than 10 finance properties or whatever the rule is that they need to break. That's where we can do it, is with portfolio lenders. Just figure out the rules you need to break and hit up them and, you know, share with them your portfolio and the cash flow that it produces and have an actual discussion with someone who is going to look at your real estate investing business as an actual business,
right?
And evaluate it as such, as opposed to, you know, a minimum wage person
in
that's just
going
to run
yeah.
something through a desktop underwriter and have it spit out a green light yes or a red light no.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. It's so refreshing to talk to a thinking person that will actually say, hey, you know, we can do this loan. This actually makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. You know, rather than using a desktop underwriter, exactly. What do you want to say about the private money then? And also, in terms of the portfolio loans, do you include credit unions in that? Because
yeah.
I've had some great deals from credit unions.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. Portfolio lenders, kind of in my world and in my vernacular, it just is a term that collectively refers to local banks and credit unions.
Right. Good mm-hmm. stuff. And by the way, just for general banking, a lot of times the credit unions can be fantastic too. So
yeah,
the big banks seem to have co-opted that you're going to go to B of A or Chase to open a checking account or Wells, right? But a lot of these credit unions are just fantastic. Service is good. Fees are low if you're on the side of, you know, borrowing money or just doing general banking. I mean, they're really quite great. Always
yep.
take advantage of those. What about the private side?
I like to say that all roads lead to private money. That's my preferred method of funding every single one of my deals, 100% across the board. I learned how to raise private capital from a hard money lender who turned me down one time. And basically, his name was Ed Warman. And, you know, I thank God for him every day. He was a little angel that was like dropped into my lap in my life. Back.
He's the one that turned you down?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of outing him here.
Yeah, he's cool with it. Yeah. He's, you know, and he had a reason to turn me down. It was a good reason.
Okay.
But basically, you know, I was desperate. I wasn't able to qualify for bank financing. It was early in my career. And I had these great deals that I needed to get funding on. And so I had figured out hard money. And so I was funding most of my deals with hard money. And then I went to get another deal funded with hard money. And the reason for the turndown was basically, look, you know, we're too exposed. You know, we've loaned on too high of a percentage of your overall portfolio, and we want to kind of scale it back a little bit in case something happens. It's going to be a domino effect that's going to take us out. And I get that right now. Back then, it was just like, oh, I can't believe you're saying no. But now I, you know, from an underwriting perspective and having, you know, managed my own hard money fund, I get it. So I just said to him, look, in full transparency, I just need some help. And I was wondering if I could take you to lunch and just ask you some questions. And we went to lunch and he said, look, I'm still not going to approve your loan, but I'm going to explain to you exactly what I do to raise capital from my investment partners to fund these deals. Because really all a hard money lender is brokering other people's investment capital. And it's usually a combination of their own capital and capital that they've raised from others that they're just brokering out to you. And certainly, you know, once I figured out, hey, I can cut out the middleman, and instead of having to pay 4 points and 15%, which was the going rate in my market at that time, I could, you know, form my own relationships with individual investors, and I could probably get funding from them anywhere at that time from like 7% to 9% with 0 points. Today, we're raising capital from individual investment partners. Roberta Eastman is my student that currently holds the record for the lowest rate, and she's running at 3.55% to a debt investor on private money. So we're getting it in the threes and the fours right now. So it's
wow. Okay,
private money is the absolute best way, in my professional opinion, to fund any real estate deal.
So I don't want any of my borrowers, I loan a lot of my own money out on private loans. I don't want any of my borrowers to hear this show because I charge a lot more than that. Okay, so tell us about that.
Hey, you know what? When I had a hard money fund and I was a hard money lender for several years in this market, and I charged 4 points and 15%. And now, you know, on the occasion when I loan out my own money, it's certainly not at 3 or 4%. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I'm usually getting, you know, 12 and 2 or 12 and 1, somewhere in that range. But what are the terms on those loans? Like, how long are those loans and what's the LTV? And tell us a little bit about that. Are those all designed for fix and flip type deals?
No, it's all across the board.
Okay.
And the bottom line is that, you know, I think that there needs to be a paradigm shift in terms of the way that real estate investors think of private money. You know, when I talk to a real estate investor about raising private money from an individual investor, you know, they automatically go into this, oh, I'm back into the borrowing money mode, and I need to talk to this quote unquote lender, and I need to see what this lender is quote unquote going to offer me, and are they going to approve me, and all that stuff. Wrong. That's the complete wrong way to approach it. When you are raising private capital from individual investors, and even, you know, to a certain extent, institutional investors, it's your private money program. You are soliciting investment into some sort of a private real estate offering, right? And so you control the terms, you control the rates, you control the fees. Now, you know, you made the comment that like, hey, you know, I don't want anybody to know this because I loan my money at 2 points and 12%. Well, that's true, right? You would be kind of a quasi-institutional investor because you do this professionally, right? What we're talking about is going out to, you know, if you ever look at the way that startups get funded, right? There are different rounds of funding for startups.
Sure, there's the first seed round, capital, the friends, families, and fools, the real capital, the angels come after that, and then, you know, mezzanine and, you know, bigger,
So like that's, you know, the funding stages for raising capital for a startup. This is pretty similar. And so where we focus in raising capital from the individual investor is from that friends, family, and, you know, in
fools.
I know. And I hate to say fool. I refuse to say fools because I don't think it's fools, but I call it friends, family, acquaintances, and accredited investors. So it's FFAA is the acronym in my world.
Got it.
And so really we're putting together an investment opportunity, and then you're pitching it to your friends, your family, and people in your network and other accredited investors that you may get an introduction to through those people.
And you're telling them you'll pay them 3.99%?
You're telling them you're going to pay whatever you have decided you're going to pay on that particular investment.
Right.
That's the first way. So, you know, people come to me all the time and ask the wrong question. And the wrong question is, how much do I pay my private money partners? The right question to ask yourself is, how much can this investment afford to pay my private money partners?
Okay. Good point.
So you need to run the numbers on each individual deal to see what that investment can afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a method, and this is something that we just discovered a couple of years ago, you know, based on feedback from several students. And it was a process that we were testing that ended up working out really well. And it is the exact reason why Roberta was able to get that debt investor at 3.5%. And so we ask a question now, right, before we divulge like what we're prepared to pay. When I sit down with an individual investor prospect, somebody, you know, that may be considering investing in my deal, I ask them the question, you know, the money that you're considering investing in this opportunity, where's it coming from? Like, what is that money currently earning?
Right. And by comparison there, it's fantastic because you'll say, look, you're earning maybe 0.5% in the bank, and I'll pay you 4, 6, 8 times that amount.
Yeah. Bingo. Right. So what we hear now is, you know, most of these people are taking this money from their IRA, their 401ks, they're rolling it over to a self-directed IRA or 401k, and then they're writing a check out of that. And these mutual funds, you know, the answers are all over the board. It's like negative, you know, or 0.5%, like you say, 1%. Mm-hmm. So compelling offer when somebody says, look, the money that I'm considering investing into your deal is currently only earning 1%, for us to come back and say, cool, well, what if we could triple that? Well, wow, right? Now we're talking. Now we have an individual investor who is going to get triple the return that money has been historically getting. And, you know, we get a debt partner at 3%.
Absolutely. Okay, good stuff. Susan, anything you'd like to wrap up with here in terms of anything we've talked about, or just a general comment on real estate investing, just to sum it all up for us?
You know, I think that it has to do with mindset. And this is something that I talk about a lot. And I had a conversation with a guy that I'm consulting with at the highest level. You know, he's raising like $16 million for a residential development in La Jolla, California. And, you know, he has had success raising capital from institutions, and now he wants to establish relationships with individual investment partners. And so he came to me to learn how to do that. And this is a guy who has a tremendous amount of success, I mean, in real estate across the board. He's a successful developer. The returns that he's paid to these institutional investors has been phenomenal over the years. And he said to me, you know, how do I kind of get out of my own head when I'm pitching my friends and my family on these deals without feeling like, you know, I have that gross pit of the stomach feeling where I feel like I'm borrowing money or begging for money? And it was a testament to the fact that no matter how much you have accomplished in real estate, you're always going to feel a little bit less than, and you're always going to feel a little bit inferior to the next person, and certainly a little bit inferior to the people who have the purse strings, right? The banks, the investment partners, and so forth. My wrap-up comment has to do with, you know what? Orrin Claff, who wrote a really great book called Pitch Anything.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book.
Yeah. He's made a comment once, you know, I don't agree with a lot of what Orrin says, you know, because he approaches raising private capital very differently than I do. But he said one thing that made a lot of sense. And he said, when you're approaching people for capital, just remember that they only have one thing. They only come with money, and money is a commodity, and it can be found anywhere. You have something different to offer. You have an opportunity. And if that one person with money passes on that opportunity, there are a couple of billion other people who have access to money, that commodity, that can invest with you. So point being, you're never going to be at the end, and you're never going to be looking back and going, oh, cool, I've learned everything I need to learn, and I've done everything I need to do and accomplished everything I need to accomplish in real estate. It's an ongoing effort every single day. And as long as you take care and manage your mindset appropriately, and recognize that you are doing something good in this world, then I think you're going to be A-okay.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. Susan, give out your website. Tell people where they can learn more about you.
Sure. So head over to my main company website and blog. It's called theinvestorinsights.com. So it's T-H-E, investorinsights.com. And that'll, you know, you can take a look at the blog posts that we have there that are very popular, and it'll give you a sense of what we do and how you can work with us more.
Fantastic. Susan, thank you so much for joining us, and happy investing.
Thank you. You too.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.